whackness in the name of blackness. You are listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com.
Ricardo Muhammad from Union City, Georgia is feeling both Maxwell and Culture Club. That's right. Okay, if you all are near a computer, look at the picture of Maxwell that we've put up. Rod Guinier, Culver City, California. This is what Rod Guinier says. He says, perhaps I shouldn't say this, but this brother whose photo is on your screen now, he looks like a serial killer with the horn-rimmed glasses and the lumberjack shirt. Glenn from Philly checked in earlier. He says, peace said, enjoying the show. Market trading relatively flat today. Investors digesting earnings reports and Bernanke testimony. Also, he likes the new Bruce Lee intro with Gangstar. It is almost a metaphor for life, and it was used in a hot Master Killer song. Love Master Killer, by the way. One of the Klan members I have a soft spot for. Everybody, check out GlennWilliamsJr.com. GlennWilliamsJr.com. JR.com, GlennWilliamsJr.com. Nimba from Côte d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, is going to send me some Côte d'Ivoire music. Coup Décalé. It's a musical genre originated from the Ivory Coast. It is the most popular musical style of Africa, he says. Okay, send me some music, brother. Send it to saidboogie@gmail.com. Saidboogie@gmail.com. Y'all be sending me big files, man, to email accounts that can't hold it. Saidboogie@gmail.com. CEDBOOGIE@gmail.com. Let me hit you with some more Maxwell. Let me tell you another thing I like about Maxwell is he keeps his album to like 9 songs. He doesn't need 14 tracks with 18 collabos. Yeah, that's right. My math don't work. 14 tracks, 18 collabos. Maxwell don't get down like that. Rod Guinier says he looks like a serial killer. This is called Fistful of Tears, Maxwell.
Sobering, stimulating, and hot. It's the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Program.
Let me get into what my beef was with Maxwell. I'm not a big Maxwell fan. What I give him credit for, though, is originating or innovating his own style. I like any artist that develops a strong live show or stage career, which I think he has. Obviously, the Prince, D'Angelo, and Kim influences are strong. Well, he came out before Kim, so maybe I shouldn't say that. But here's how the beef started with Maxwell. I didn't like the Now album as much as, what was the other one, Embryo? I just found the album cover troubling. Let's bring that up. If you all like the Now album more than this new one, let me know. I haven't found anyone yet. Oh, let me make an announcement. The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan will be speaking live via webcast. The title of the subject is The Crucifixion of Michael Jackson and All Responsible Black Leadership. Sunday, July 26, 2009. Live program starts at 10 a.m. Central Time. The Crucifixion of Michael Jackson and All Responsible Black Leadership, Sunday, July 26, 2009, 10 a.m. Central. That's NOI.org, NOI.org. Put the guitar on them, Maxwell.
Most eclectic audience on radio, only on the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee program.
Song, nice. Now, this is the album photo that bothered me. I just didn't like the way he was looking at me. If you want to pop a look at your screen, it's just the tilt of the head is kind of troubling to me, unsettling. I want to take a look. This is the cover of Maxwell's album. Now, this is when we kind of had a falling out. Not just that, but I need you, Maxwell supporters, to educate me. What was the album where he got the video where he's sitting in the dirty bathwater? That was it. Maxwell in the dirty bathwater looking at me with the head tilted. Just a little unsettling, I'll say. I'm going to leave this album up. If you all had the same feeling about this album cover, let me know. The song is called Know These Things.
How could you know these things?
If you want to comment on that, on the Now album cover, let me know. Am I off base? I just didn't feel right. You know what I mean? Just kind of looking at me with the tilted head. It's a little unsettling.
Knowledge, wisdom, and understanding only on the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee program.
I'm going to get into the gangster of the week. I need you all to help me find out who this person is, identify him. This was 2 weeks ago on Al Jazeera TV. Nothing like Caucasian on Caucasian violence. We know this from the 30 Years War, the 100 Years War. When Caucasians get at it, it just goes to another level. Yes, I'm tuning into Al Jazeera religiously. Just a phenomenal network. They're my favorite right now. France 24, I'm feeling you. Russia Today, I'm feeling you. I'm feeling SABC, South Africa Broadcasting Corporation. I'm feeling Euronews, a slept-on program. Euronews. But right now, it's no doubt that Al Jazeera has the crown. Can't get enough of them. The only thing about Al Jazeera is they, which is probably to their credit, they play a lot of news clips where the... It's kind of hard to follow. You get to watch the screen because they'll play like something in Spanish and they'll just keep it going. But in any event, this man interviewing Newt Gingrich is without a doubt the gangster of the last 2 weeks. Listen closely how he walks Newt Gingrich into his sights for target practice. Never heard nothing like this before in my life. This is a Caucasian now. Two Caucasians fighting it out on Al Jazeera. Watch how smoothly this man gets down. The show is called Fault Lines. Fault Lines on Al Jazeera.
There are people who are deeply opposed to the rule of law. And I think we're going to always have people who criticize as long as we represent freedom in the broadest and most modern sense.
But, okay, to quote you, it's a long way from here to there. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the greatest military in the world. More than half of the United States' discretionary spending is already going to defense. What do you need more for?
You know, I clearly believe that it's better to have the United States as the leading power in the world rather than have China as the leading power in the world. And I think those are the only two practical choices in the next 30 years.
Vice President Joe Biden recently stirred the pot again on the issue of Israel having a preemptive strike on Iran. What's your view? In the past, you've called for the bombing of Iran's oil refineries.
No, I haven't. I've called for sabotage, not bombing.
Forgive me. Sabotage, not bombing.
Sure. The fundamental difference. What I've said is you should use covert operations because they only have one refinery that produces gasoline in the entire country, and they have to import all the rest of their gasoline. They produce a lot of crude oil, but not enough gasoline for the economy. I think that a nuclear Iran is a danger to every one of the states in the Persian Gulf. I think that a nuclear Iran is a danger to Saudi Arabia, a danger to Iraq. I think it's a danger to Europe. And I think this is not just an Israeli problem. The Iranians are as interested in dominating the Gulf as they are in eliminating Israel.
And so sabotaging oil refineries rather than
The only purpose of sabotaging them would be to create a gasoline-led crisis to try to replace the regime. I mean, I'm against using tactics that don't have any strategic meaning. I think we have a vested interest, the world has a vested interest, in a responsible Iranian government, just as we have a vested interest in a responsible North Korean government.
Which you can precipitate by provoking a gas crisis with black ops sabotage?
Okay, this is where it starts to turn a little bit. The show is Fault Lines. The host of Fault Lines, he sets up Newt Gingrich as a normal conversation, a little bit of disagreement. Now he starts to walk him into his sights.
Well, I think that would be...
Like, that's the scenario that you have suggested here.
Look, I think that's one piece out of many. Just as if I had said to you in 1979, gosh, why don't we help solidarity as a union, which led to a crisis in 1980, which led to freedom in 1989, you'd have said that doesn't seem very realistic. Well, in 1989, the Soviet Empire began to disintegrate. Now, there was a grand strategy that included economic, political, diplomatic, and psychological aspects that collectively had a huge impact on the Soviet Union.
We've got to take a break, but we'll be back with more of this conversation with Newt Gingrich in a moment. We're back on Fault Lines in conversation with Newt Gingrich. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
There was an article that caught my eye this week in the New York Times that welfare checks in the state of New York are going up for the first time in 19 years.
Get him.
As the architect of welfare reform, which ended up with millions and millions of Americans losing access to state subsidies in the 1990s. What do you think of that?
Well, first of all, the welfare reform led 65% of the people on welfare to either go to school or get a job, which was, I think, a net advantage, and virtually every study has said.
Those are contested statistics.
I don't think so. I think almost every study has said that they ended up being better off, they ended up with higher incomes, and they ended up with greater freedom and better lives.
Actually, in the late 90s, the Department of Health and Human Services did 15 studies of families who lost access to welfare, 15 state studies. So in 15 states, they found that in 12 of them, people who left welfare and found jobs had average incomes that were below the poverty line. We know that in the mid-90s, that was the transition to the three minimum wage job family who were the working poor and the explosion of that population in this country. That's your legacy.
My legacy is people who went to work, gradually learned how to work, gradually got better jobs. Most people who start at minimum wage jobs, in fact, get better jobs over time and rise. Most people who never get their first job never rise because they never get any work habits, they never get any experience. And I would argue that the greatest single cause of poverty in America today is the collapse of the school systems, which no longer achieve what they should be achieving. If you look at a place like Detroit, where only 26% of the entering freshmen graduate from high school, and 3 out of every 4 students is being cheated. You can't in the modern world get a decent job if you can't even get a high school education. So I would argue that a great deal of what we think of as poverty in America is actually a function of the collapse of the school systems and a collapse of social cohesion in those neighborhoods. And we need much deeper and stronger strategies to get those folks back into the workforce and to get them back into learning.
I don't think anyone would argue that education in the United States is in trouble. But what I'm getting at is that there was a fundamental change in the 90s, and your contract with America and the Clinton administration's embrace of your policies led to the starkest inequality in the United States, essentially since the Gilded Age.
I think that we ought to talk about why do you have inequality in America, because the primary centers of inequality are places where they don't have education, they don't have a work ethic, and the result is people don't rise. And what happens is everywhere in America, no matter what your ethnic background, if you don't get pregnant before you're married and you don't get married till you graduate from high school, it is virtually impossible to end up in poverty. Now, that's not technically true in this immediate problem, because you now have 9.4% unemployment.
Is that why you favored cutting teen mothers off welfare in the 90s? Because that was one of the tenets.
No, what I favored was encouraging people, first of all, to go to school. And what we said basically was, you have several years you can be on welfare, but by the end of that time, you have to either go to school or get a job.
Now, family, I'll do a show on welfare reform. I've exposed some stuff, never been challenged about how they keep statistics. This man is walking and has walked Newt Gingrich for about 7 minutes into his sights. It gets worse. This is the gangster of the week, the host of Fault Lines, a program on Al Jazeera. I don't know his name.
The other location of inequality in America is on Wall Street and in the top 1% of the top 1% of where fountains of money have been made, and they have not trickled down in the last decade. I think even you would admit that. So do we need massive re-regulation on Wall Street now?
I always find it fascinating to have somebody from the Gulf interview me on inequality.
I'm actually from Canada. But
I know, but you're interviewing on behalf of Al Jazeera, so why don't we talk about the largest centers of inequality on the planet?
Well, I think...
Let's start with the Saudi families. I mean, would we like to start with how much they're worth, how much money they get as rentiers?
I'd like to remind you that you are not a citizen of the world, but a citizen of the United States, and we're here to talk about the United States.
I'm just trying to understand the frame of reference.
My frame of reference is whether or not you think that the bubbles that have been inflated under both Democrat and Republican administrations in this country in the last 20 years led to this inequality, and whether or not right now there is a moment when Wall Street needs to be massively re-regulated, or whether we're heading for yet another crash.
First of all, the Europeans have far more regulations, and European banks are in worse shape. Second, the leading cause of the bubbles was bad policy by the Federal Reserve. And it's the Federal Reserve which printed too much money, created too low an interest rate, so you had a government-led bubble. Okay. Third, the U.S. government adopted a policy that said, if you can't afford to buy a house, we'll find a way to cheat. And so they tried to put millions of people into homes they couldn't afford. That helped artificially create a housing market that shouldn't have existed. And that was a government-led bubble.
So just to be clear, do you favor more deregulation at this point?
I favor more transparency and more accountability. And I think
you've called for the repeal of the Sarbanes-Oxley law, for instance, which was the accounting laws that went into...
I'll give you a simple example. I wouldn't have bailed out AIG. If you didn't bail out AIG, Goldman Sachs had to pay $13 billion. These were all sophisticated investors. Mm-hmm. They all did stupid things. Why should the average taxpayer have to bail out rich people who do stupid things?
Rich guys get a chance to be way more stupid when there's no rules governing, for instance, how much leverage and how much debt those federally regulated, in theory, institutions can take on. The deregulation under both Clinton and Bush allowed those companies to speculate in a way that never would have been allowed under the laws that were put in place after the Great Depression.
We've had every 20 years, we've had a financial crisis. We had Penn Central go broke. We had the fourth largest bank in the United States go broke under Reagan. We've had routine processes because if you have a capitalist system, at the margin, some capitalists are dumb. And they go out and they get overly leveraged, and they take gambles that don't work, and they get in trouble. The trick is to let the people who fail, fail.
Let's talk a little bit about the intersection of religion and politics. Because you talk a little bit, in fact, you talk regularly in your speeches about something you call the irreconcilable wing of Islam.
Sure.
And you've talked about regimes that don't respect women's rights, etc., here, today. And yet you feel very passionately that reaffirming in the Pledge of Allegiance in the United States that it is one nation under God and having a talk of God in the public and the political sphere is important. I'm having trouble reconciling those things, that religion, your view that religion is incredibly important, intrinsic to the political climate here, but it's somehow unacceptable in other places.
No, I didn't say it was unacceptable. I mean, I am totally comfortable with people having deep religious faith. My first assertion is very straightforward. If you look at the Sharia, as applied by the most traditional wing of Islam, and you look at the rules of people like the Taliban, they are clearly not reconcilable with the modern world.
But the point is isn't the problem just religious fundamentalism, period?
No. I have no problem with the Amish, who are quite fundamentalist. On the other hand, the founding document of the United States, our Declaration of Independence, says we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. Now, actually, any of the monotheistic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, can understand that sentence. And the question is, do you believe the rights of Americans come from God and are inalienable? Or do you believe the rights of Americans come from lawyers and judges and bureaucrats and politicians and can be reshaped at will? That's a very fundamental dividing line about the nature of the world.
I want to ask you one last thing, and I
you saved it for last because it'll be fun.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, you admitted that you were having an extramarital affair while you were skewering Bill Clinton daily for the Monica Lewinsky affair. And I wondered whether you wanted to apologize.
No, what I said then, and what I'm happy to say as often as needed, is committing perjury in front of a federal judge is in fact a felony. A Yale law graduate thoroughly understands it's a felony. Lying under oath in a civil case is in fact something I don't think you want to go down the road of.
But there's also lying to the American people, for instance, that leading them into a war. Those are also presidential lies. They might not be under oath.
And they're actionable.
But they're still lies.
And they're actionable by the Congress, if the Congress thinks that it's inappropriate. The question is...
So you think George W. Bush should have been impeached?
No. I said it's so that the Congress thinks they're appropriate. First of all, I don't accept the way you jumped from an explicit, undeniable lie...
No, there's no question about that.
...to your assertion, which I don't agree with. Mm-hmm. I don't think George W. Bush lied to us. I think that's fundamentally false. I believe that every senior person, including Colin Powell, believed at the time what they were saying. I think they believed they had evidence from the British intelligence, the French intelligence, and the Russian intelligence that said that the American intelligence was right. And I think that it is fundamentally dishonest to go back and rewrite history about George W. Bush. In the case of Clinton, the point I made was very straightforward. Presidents should have to be under the law. He was not acting. And I can say, look, I went through two divorces.
Right.
In both divorces, I took depositions. In both divorces, I was told in advance I was going to swear an oath to tell the truth. I took seriously telling the truth. This is a question about whether or not presidents should be allowed to commit a felony.
I think it's a question about whether or not politicians have a responsibility to apologize when they're guilty of hypocrisy.
I wasn't being a hypocrite. That's my very point to you. I said, my argument with Clinton was that he committed a felony in front of a sitting federal judge.
But seriously, I lived through that time too. And you and lots of other Republicans were not confining your objections to the president's behavior to this narrow legalistic point. You were making political hay out of the fact that he had an affair.
You and I just disagree. I don't believe committing a felony in front of a federal judge is a minor point. I believe it's at the heart of the rule of law. And I think one of the things which has made America historically different from other countries is that we actually take pretty seriously the rule of law. And we are permanently surprised by our own failings. in a way that other countries wouldn't even notice. And I think it's one of the things that makes us very different.
The rule of law in interviews suggests that we're out of time, but I thank you for your time. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Family, that man, if you listen to that interview, it was so gangster how he did it. There's only one thing we can play and saluted the host of Fault Lines. The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan speaks on the crucifixion of Michael Jackson Sunday, July 26th. www.noi.org. That man, Fault Lines, the host, what's his name? He's a smooth criminal. Newt Gingrich, you've been hit by... You've been struck by. Newt, are you okay? I'm gonna play my favorite Maxwell song in a minute, but I gotta salute the host of Fault Lines on Al Jazeera.
Oil refinery.
No, I haven't. I've called for sabotage, not bombing.
Forgive me. Sabotage, not bombing.
Sure, the fundamental difference. What I've said is you should use covert operations because they only have one refinery that produces gasoline in the entire country, and they have to import all the rest of their gasoline. They produce a lot of crude oil, but not enough gasoline for the economy. I think that a nuclear Iran is a danger to every one of the states in the Persian Gulf. I think that a nuclear Iran is a danger to Saudi Arabia, a danger to Iraq. I think it's a danger to Europe. And I think this is not just an Israeli problem. The Iranians are as interested in dominating the Gulf as they are in eliminating Israel.
And so sabotaging oil refineries rather than...
The only purpose of sabotaging them would be to create a gasoline-led crisis to try to replace the regime. I mean, there's no... I'm against using tactics that don't have any strategic meaning.
Fault Lines on Al Jazeera, one of my new favorite shows. Right up there with Tiny and Toya and the T.O. Show.
Black Ops sabotage?
I think that would be...
Like, that's a scenario that you have suggested.
Look, I think that's one piece out of many. Just as if I had said to you in 1979, gosh, why don't we help Solidarity as a union, which led to a crisis in 1980, which led to freedom in 1989, you just said that doesn't seem very realistic. Well, in 1989, the Soviet Empire began to disintegrate. Now, there was a grand strategy that included economic, political, diplomatic, and psychological aspects that collectively had a huge impact on the Soviet Union.
We've got to take a break, but we'll be back with more of this conversation with Newt Gingrich in a moment.
Smooth criminal. Hey, Facebook, as some of you all know, I like to build on business by giving examples of products and services that people use and enjoy. It's an easy way to learn the science of business. Just study whatever it is that you buy or enjoy. Facebook. This was on CNBC last week. We're all enjoying Facebook. Here's the business model and where things might be headed.
Facebook's estimated value may be down from its $15 billion high a couple of years ago, but there's no doubt that the social networking site has achieved unprecedented popularity, crossing the 200 million member threshold and launching its young founder into wealth and some controversy as well. Joining us this morning is Ben Mizrich. He's the author of The Accidental Billionaires, the founding of Facebook, and he joins us from New York with, I guess, a story that, although Zuckerberg, Ben, is well known, people may not know exactly what the initial motive for starting this was, or for at least discovering the model, right?
Yeah, I mean, really, it was a couple of geeky kids at Harvard who could not meet girls. And they essentially, it was a college prank that really led to Facebook. Late one night, Mark Zuckerberg was in his room after a bad date, and he hacked into all the computers at Harvard and pulled up pictures of every girl on campus, and he made a hot or not website, and everyone could vote on who the hottest girl at Harvard was. and that cracked all the stuff at Harvard, and it kind of led to the creation of Facebook.
You have put this story together, it sounds like with the help of his friend at the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, his best friend at the time was a kid, Eduardo, and the two of them were, you know, geeky kids. They met in an underground Jewish fraternity at Harvard, and Eduardo, you know, neither one of them were meeting a lot of girls, and Mark basically built the company. Eduardo put up $1,000 in the beginning to help him do it, and they were best friends for a while until everything fell apart.
Why did it fall apart? Why do they no longer speak?
Well, basically, you know, it was a dorm room company. The thing exploded. Suddenly, there were millions of people on it. Mark went off to California and really built the company in Silicon Valley. Eduardo finished school, and a lot of tensions grew, and then slowly but surely, Mark, you know, decided that it was his company. Eduardo wasn't doing anything, and then there was some betrayal. Eduardo feels like he was betrayed, and then there was this kid, Sean Parker, who is kind of the rock star. He's kind of the bad boy of Silicon Valley. He got involved and really brought Facebook from a dorm room company to $1 billion company.
Does Zuckerberg deserve as much credit as he gets for starting this? I mean, could it have happened without him?
No, absolutely. Mark Zuckerberg is an absolute genius. Without Mark Zuckerberg, there would be no Facebook. I mean, the kid, he's like a Bill Gates. I mean, I can say, you know, nothing good enough about Mark. But, you know, he's socially very different. I mean, he has this kind of wall around him, and it's very ironic that the kid who created the biggest social network in the world is very socially awkward, and I think he sheds friends along the way because he's so focused. He doesn't think like everyone else. His best friend is his computer, and it's this world he's created.
Yeah, you paint a picture of him as this kid who is literally just writing code, like, all the time, right?
I mean, you know, he's a workaholic. He's a billionaire now who basically spends all his time working, and he's not going to be the guy with the giant yacht and hanging out with the supermodels. He's going to be the guy late at night with the glow of the screen on his face because that's what his obsession is.
So how much, to what degree is there sour grapes among the other guys who were there at the beginning and are obviously not living to enjoy the fruits of some of their labors?
Listen, there's a lot of kids who claim they founded Facebook. That's the first thing I discovered as I dug into this story. There are definitely people who feel like Mark, you know, did them wrong along the way. And the way Mark looks at it is essentially, you know, he's a kid who was struck by lightning and everyone kind of around him tries to hold on as he goes up into the stratosphere. It's hard to say, but there's definitely anger from him, from Eduardo. There was anger from the Winklevoss twins, who are these giant 6'5" Olympic rowers.
Yes.
The really good-looking guys. They were kind of the kings of Harvard. And they were making a dating website, something called the Harvard Connection. They had brought Mark in to do their code. Mark essentially didn't really do anything for them, blew them off, and then launched Facebook. So they feel like he stole the idea from them. It's a pretty interesting story, but it all takes place this sophomore year at Harvard.
You know, Ben, the big question people have is what comes next with social networking? What knocks out Facebook, or does Facebook evolve? What's your sense from talking to all these people?
I really feel that Facebook is the next step in human evolution. I really feel like we've gone from the village, the city, to Facebook. Facebook is at 200 million users, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I see no reason why it doesn't have 1 billion users in a year or two. I think it is the next thing. It evolves. I mean, Twitter, you know, Twitter's fun. Listen, everyone's having a great time with Twitter. I enjoy Twitter, but I've heard it said it's like the Macarena of the internet. It's a short-term kind of fun thing.
I tried Facebook for a couple months, and I knocked myself off that, too.
I mean, there are definitely people who don't love it, but the majority of people who go on it spend 3-4 hours a day on it. And
hours a day?
Absolutely.
Go to college. What's going to happen to the rest of our creation if people are spending 3-4 hours a day on
this? This is the new form of human life. I mean, look at colleges and high schools. These people spend their whole lives. Dating is through it. You meet people through it. You live on Facebook.
I mean, did Mark ever meet any hot girls? You're implying no. I mean,
He did. He actually, there's a groupie scene at Harvard. They became kind of famous at Harvard, and there's a scene in the basement of one of the dorm rooms. And then there's a scene where Mark actually went home with a Victoria's Secret model, according to sources.
So he's
done fine, although he's had a girlfriend through the whole process. So basically, he's been with the same girl from the beginning of Facebook to
now. While he was doing that other stuff, he's going to be mad at you.
Well, no, I mean, I don't really know the details of what he did with the Victoria's Secret model.
I mean, when you said the Winklevoss twins, I got excited for a second. I thought he met them, but they were big, tall guys.
They were giant guys who looked like Ben Affleck. They were like the job.
Oh, they're men. Ben, I'm sure you have heard the response from Facebook. This is what they gave us and what they've given a lot of reporters. Ben Mizrich clearly aspires to be the Jackie Collins or Danielle Steele of Silicon Valley. In fact, his own publisher put it best, the book isn't reportage, it's big, juicy fun. We particularly agree with the first part of that and think any readers will concur. Does that bother you?
No, Jackie Collins. Yeah, yeah. I love Jackie Collins.
Exactly.
And you know what? Why can't it both be Report Us and Juicy Fun?
Yeah.
I like, you know, being called Jackie Collins and Danielle Steele. I understand why Facebook is terrified of the book, but the reality is I'm the biggest proponent of Facebook. I think $6.5 billion is too small. I think it should be $15 billion. I think this company is really the future. So they should love me, but, you know, they don't.
The book has been optioned by Sony Pictures, yes?
It's bigger than that. We've actually, Kevin Spacey, Dana Brunetti, and Scott Rudin, Mike DeLuca are producing the movie. Aaron Sorkin adapted it.
That's
and
a big deal.
I believe David Fincher is going to direct it, which is amazing.
Wow.
So we'll see.
Do you have a Facebook page?
I do, and I have a fan site for the book on Facebook. It's very meta.
They haven't
We're selling
shut it
this
down
book.
Yet?
You know, they haven't. I don't think they will. They're all about freedom of information, right? So I have it. I love Facebook. I've been on it. I'm a fan. I'm on it all the time.
Ben, it's fascinating. Best of luck with that and, of course, with the film.
Hey,
look
thanks
forward
so
to
much.
Talking to you again.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
July 22nd. 2009. This is my favorite Maxwell song. I don't know if this is the one where he had the video with the dirty bathwater and he was looking at me sideways. I did, very, very unsettling. Keenan from Chicago, I see you. We had to compare oils. It's inside. This was from the Embryo album about 10 years ago, I think. If you're feeling this at your cubicle, let me know. I can sing this too. It's just a bunch of breathing.
Watchman, Cedric Muhammad on the Black Coffee Channel.
Teach me, follow me. Tell me what you thought, I thought you thought, I thought. Use me, train me. All the things you want, you know, girl, can't be
from the top, one more time.
Watchman, Cedric Muhammad on the Black Coffee Channel.
Is this song about a marriage proposal? Matrimony, Maybe You, that's the name. Maybe this is about marriage. I got three marriage songs. One from Chic Looch, one from R. Kelly, and this one from Maxwell. Now. I will rap and sing them for you one day. Yeah, I said Chic Looch from LOX. Got a hot song, one name. One more time, Maxwell, from the top. I'm losing my voice. I may try to sing this.
You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
My voice is shot. I don't know what happened. I've been drinking water too. It's gone. Go cop this new Maxwell album if you want to hear. Nothing like this on there, but top to bottom, very nice album. Philadelphia Phillies, go get Roy Halladay. Come prepared next week. Tiny and Toya and T.O. show reviews. I'm going to talk about 7-Eleven, too. I wanted to get to that. Not enough time. 7-Eleven next week. The business model of 7-Eleven, if you want to look at that. The show has ended at just the right time. I have totally lost my voice. Send in comments. SaidBoogie@gmail.com is the email. SaidBoogie@gmail.com. SaidBoogie@gmail.com. I'm feeling Victor Ortiz. He might retire from boxing before he gets hurt. I could care less about Manny Pacquiao, Miguel Cotto, Bob Arum, WWE that. Miguel Cotto should win if everything's on the up and up, but you never know with Bob Arum. I got some Bob Arum, Muhammad Ali, Nation of Islam stories one day, one day. Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan speaks on Michael Jackson Sunday, 10 a.m. Central Time, NOI.org. I want to thank Amos Oriku checking in from Nairobi, Kenya. And our brother from Congo. I think it was a brother. I'll get the name in a minute. Rod Ginyar, Culver City, California, one of the best that ever did it. Everyone's looking for Natasha from Miami. Haven't heard from her in a while. It was a gentleman, I think, from Greensboro, North Carolina, from Congo. Kambale. Kambale from the Congo. Thank you very much for your valuable contribution.
Black Coffee Channel, home of the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Radio Program.
See those Skip Gates arrest photos on t-shirts throughout hoods all over the world by next week.
give you the first cue as to the nature of the great master key, which has been responsible for all the great successes in every calling, in every part of the world. Please listen carefully to what I have to say, because you may discover the secret of the master key in this first visit. You may get your first cue as to the nature of the great master key when I tell you that psychologists have discovered a natural law which is the very foundation of all personal successes. And I can describe it to you in one short sentence so you can understand it. Whatever the mind can conceive and believe, the mind can achieve.